From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect, and I'm Bonnie North. On the show today, we'll hear about a TV special that tells some of the other stories about the March on Washington 50 years ago. And Congressman John Lewis remembers being there, ready to speak.
People were already walking, and we just sort of locked on and started walking. And it was like, there go my people, let me catch up with them. And the sea of humanity just literally pushed us on past the Washington Monument toward the Lincoln Memorial.
Harley Fest throttles up in Milwaukee this week, and we'll hear about some of the events that are planned. And through a fictional character, a local author unpicks the knot of the cycle of abuse.
You are not meant to forgive her. You are meant to learn how this could happen. How could a woman become someone who could burn her child with cigarettes?
Stay tuned for Lake Effect. News is first. Welcome to Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. This week marks the 50th anniversary of the historic March on Washington. That march catalyzed the changes in civil rights for African Americans that would be fought for through the 1960s and beyond. It was also the event that enshrined Dr. Martin Luther King among the greatest orators of our time. Hundreds of thousands of people packed the National Mall in Washington, D.C. for that event. Among them were many from Wisconsin. But of course, the March on Washington affected the lives of many who did not make the trip east. Television producer Joanne Williams is telling an often overlooked story of the March on Washington in a special episode of the public television series Black Nouveau. She tells Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke what she set out to do in the program.
Producer Everett Marshburn and I thought about doing something for the 50th anniversary. We thought about this back in April, and we said we don't want to do the common just list of people who've been there, although we want to include them. We want to tell the stories of why, what happened behind the scenes, and the people you may not remember. My first comment to Everett was, most people remember the March on Washington as the fuzzy black and white video of Martin Luther King making the I Have a Dream speech. But there was a lot more to it. So we decided to set out and tell the story of Bayard Rustin, who did most of the organizing for the march, of A. Philip Randolph, the man who founded the Pullman Porters Brotherhood, the first black union of railroad workers. They were the two people who actually organized the march. And Dr. King was one of 6 to 10 people who came into the march and then participated in it. So we had to do a lot of additional research in that to find out more about Bayard Rustin and about A. Philip Randolph. Finding things about Dr. King was pretty easy. What wasn't easy is finding sound of these other men and telling the story about how they brought the march to life and how Dr. King was part of it.
Well, and I wonder, do you think there's a risk in over-romanticizing this as Dr. King's moment?
That's one of the reasons that we wanted to take this approach. Since most people don't know that much about the march except for King's speech, they think of it as only a march for civil rights. But it was originally a march for jobs and freedom. It was a march to get people fair housing, fair employment, raise the minimum wage, better education. All those issues were the reasons that they had the march. And civil rights became part of it. Those are also civil rights issues. So it gets sort of romanticized when you think of the speech because it was such an emotional, such a powerful speech. But it was only one of several speeches that day, and we wanted to tell you the story of the other people involved.
Well, and 50 years later, I think we do often think of civil rights as a single issue, but you raise a really important idea that civil rights is a plural. This is not just one thing. This is all of these things, and they were all represented at this march.
One of the people we talked to was Kurt Schmoke, the former mayor of Baltimore, who went to the march when he was a teenager. His mother said to him, "You're going to go." And he knew better than to not do what his mother told him, so he went. He had no idea of what it was going to be like or how massive it was going to be. But he says in our program that civil rights has evolved from the rights of African Americans to the rights of women to the rights of disabled to now the rights of people in gender equity and then probably the rights of immigration. So civil rights keeps changing. It doesn't stop. And the movement hasn't really stopped. It's just evolved into different areas. which when you stop to think about it, that's very true. Civil rights and the issues involved are still with us.
Did you approach this as a historical documentary or as something different, as just an issue-based show?
That's an interesting question. There have been a lot of historical things written in magazines, in newspapers. You're going to see an historical documentary also on PBS Tuesday night called The March. So we didn't approach it as this is a history lesson. We approached it as this is some information that you may not have known about the march. But my philosophy has always been that news and documentary is education and history. One of the phrases I used to tell people, that news is the first draft of history. So it's a little bit of both.
You made sure that Wisconsin is represented in this special as well, correct?
Absolutely. We talked to people who went to the march from Wisconsin. George Paz Martin, who was only 16 years old at the time, he's now involved in the peace movement. He also tells the story of how Father Grappi came to pick him up. And his mother said, "You're going to go." And he said, "Where?" And his mother packed some stuff for him, and he got in the car with Father Grappi and a bunch of other people, and he went to Washington. So we tell his story. We tell the story of Ted Mack, who went to the March on Washington, and then when he came back, got involved in business in the People's Brewery. I don't know if you remember the People's Brewery, but that was an interesting story here in Milwaukee, and then some other business interests. And he talks about the kind of fear around the march before it happened, because a lot of people were afraid that this was going to turn into something violent, which of course it didn't. We talked to David Newby, who subsequently became president of the Wisconsin AFL-CIO.
And we're seeing that again, I think, in this 50th commemoration of the march, that it's become almost exclusively a civil rights commemoration and with a focus on Dr. King and labor and the jobs, economic dimension of that march has been lost as a result.
It was attending the march that inspired him to get involved in the labor movement because he saw the importance of people working together to advance their causes. And, of course, we talked to Vel Phillips, who is very familiar with Milwaukee and Milwaukeeans, who was the first African-American woman on the Common Council and the first woman on the Common Council and Supreme Court and Court Justice and many other titles that she held. But she talked very personally about being invited to the march by Thurgood Marshall, who was then very involved in the NAACP. Her husband, Dale Phillips, was the president of the Milwaukee branch of the NAACP. And she says Thurgood called them up and said, "Vel, you have to come." And she said, "Well, I don't know if I want to go." And he said, "We'll pay for you to come." And her husband said, "No, no, we can't let you do that. Besides, we don't want to get on a bus and ride for 24, 48 hours, however long it took them." So they took a plane and they flew to the march. And she said it was the best experience she'd ever had.
I remember Thurgood said, "Be sure to bring an umbrella and all like that, because it's going to be warm." But we forgot, you know. And we were on our way to the airport, and I said, "We didn't bring an umbrella." But there were people who bought 2 and 3 umbrellas, and they were generous with their blankets and their everything. That was the best, almost. Of course, the speech was historic, but the camaraderie and with the people there, everybody was there for the same purpose, and you could just imagine that they felt the same way you felt.
We think of this day 50 years ago as Dr. King's movement, but do you get a sense from the people that you spoke with that this was as much their moment?
Absolutely. It was, and it was supposed to be. That's what A. Philip Randolph and Bayard Rustin wanted it to be. They wanted it to be a day for all of the however many people showed up. They wanted them to be involved. And one of the things they did near the end of the march was a call for action. They had a list of demands. They said, "Here are the demands that we are going to present to the American people and to Congress. And we want you to go back home and take a pledge to be active in your communities, to fight for equal education, for employment, for equal housing." They wanted the people at the march to be involved. That's one of the things that they certainly did. And a lot of people did get involved in that. There are probably hundreds and hundreds of stories of people who were so inspired by this march that they went home and did something.
Well, and do you get the sense that that held true for the Wisconsinites that you spoke with, that, that this march, even though it was 1,000 miles away, had a direct and relatively immediate impact on the lives of African Americans and more in Milwaukee?
Definitely in Vel Phillips' life. She came back and worked for the open housing legislation that passed the Milwaukee Common Council just about 18 months later. Of course, Ted Mack came back and got involved in the Congress of Racial Equality, which was his organization, CORE. David Newby got involved in the labor movement, and George Paz Martin got involved in peace movements. So they got involved. But there, you know, there are probably other stories of people, Mitch, that we couldn't find who did something because they were inspired by the march. I was inspired by the march a little bit, I think, to go into news and education and information, because I thought, watching it at home on TV like millions of others, I said, that's such a moving event, and I wish I had been there.
I didn't want to presume that you were old enough to have been watching it, but you do have memories of having seen it secondhand.
I was old enough to watch it. I'll tell you, I was a teenager. I'm not going to tell you what teen number it was, but I did watch it on television and was very moved by it. You know, you have to remember, in 1963, there were only three television news networks. There was ABC, CBS, and NBC. We didn't have all these stations to choose from. So when the march was on, it was on almost every channel, so you could sort of not avoid it. So I watched it and was inspired by it, and I think a lot of other people watched it and were inspired by it. Some people, of course, took different points of view, and that's all part of the march, too. It woke up America to what was happening in civil rights in the 60s, and I think it had an impact on changing it. Of course, the Voting Rights Act of 64 and the Civil Rights Act of 65 – then came out of that because Congress said we'd better do something, because 250,000 people showed up at our front door saying, do something.
What would you hope viewers today get from all the attention being paid to this anniversary?
Well, I think that anybody who was not old enough to see it will learn from it. We'll see what happened then. We'll get a little feeling of the enthusiasm and the commitment and the emotion and the passion that people brought to Washington on that day. You know, if you look at this black and white film, which is all we had at the time, of the people who came, they were all dressed in their Sunday best. The women got dressed in dresses and hats and gloves. The men wore suits. And that was intentional. They wanted America to see that black Americans were about business. They were there dressed in their best clothes to do some business. So that's something you should look for. People probably don't realize that. I would think that people who do remember it will say to themselves and to their friends and to their families, what have we learned from this? I remember that day. Let's talk about it. If nothing else, I hope the program that we've done for Channel 10 will spark conversation between people who saw it, people who might have gone, and people who knew nothing about it except what they learn in history books. And in history books, you learn just a little bit about it. But I have read three different books about it. I got the material from Washington when we went to shoot it about the March on Washington. And I looked at I'm showing Mitch now a little brochure that you get when you go to the Lincoln Memorial. They hand you this. It's called Changing America, Youth Guide, The March on Washington. You can get this in Washington, D.C., but you can't necessarily get it in Milwaukee. So you watch our program, you'll get a feeling of what took place that day and what evolved from that and what more you can find out. We are also going to have a website up to include all of the interviews that we did. We could only include a little bit in a 30-minute program, but all of the interviews will be online. More pictures, more information, more background will be available. And I'm hoping personally that families use this as a way to spark conversation of all generations, and schools use it, it's free material, as a way to supplement what they teach about American history, because we don't really learn enough about American history.
Do you think a single event like the March on Washington could ever again have the kind of profound impact that this one event had, or was there something special, specific about that place, that time, and that group of people?
Well, there were two things specific about it. It was happening in 1963, as the Montgomery bus boycott was going on, there was so much action in the South going on that television was showing, and people were seeing it in parts of the country where they weren't familiar with it. So the awareness was starting to bubble up. The March on Washington woke a lot of people's eyes open. It was also the torch was passed at the March on Washington from A. Philip Randolph and Bayard Rustin to Martin Luther King and the civil rights, the, quote, civil rights movement. So it was passed from one generation to the next. And hopefully watching the programs, and our program in particular, of course, will pass it on to another generation to give them information about what happened. It's amazing when I talk to my kids about this and I mention these other names, they'd never heard of them. They'd heard of Martin Luther King. They've heard of Elle Phillips because they're from Milwaukee. Other than that, they had never heard of any of these people. Well, now you're going to hear about them and learn more about what they did for civil rights in the 60s.
And in the immediate future, the program actually, your program actually airs twice.
It airs at 7 o'clock tonight. It's followed by, and Tuesday night is a whole night of PBS March on Washington programming. Our program airs at 7 o'clock. It's followed by our other special that we did last year, Freedom Walkers for Milwaukee, which deals with the open housing marches across the 16th Street, now Grappi Viaduct. That'll be followed by In Performance at the White House, which will feature the music of the civil rights movement. Performing will be people like Bob Dylan and Joan Baez, the people who performed at the march originally. And that will be followed at 9 o'clock by a documentary which was produced in part by Robert Redford. It's called The March. And I've seen a little clip of it, and it says that it's going to tell you why the march almost didn't happen. And then our program, let me say it again, will be repeated on Wednesday night, which is the actual 50th anniversary, at 6:30 on Channel 10 on Black Nouveau.
Well, Joanne Williams, thank you so much for sharing the story of the program and the good work you've done with us, and hope a lot of people have a chance to tune in.
I certainly do, too. Thanks, Mitch.
Joanne Williams is the host of the series Black Nouveau on Milwaukee Public Television. The show will air a special broadcast called For Jobs and Freedom, 50 Years and Counting, both tonight and tomorrow on MPTV. There's a link to the special webpage set up to mark the anniversary at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. As Joanne Williams mentioned, her show interviewed a number of Wisconsinites who attended the March on Washington. It also features, as many news reports have in recent days, an interview with Congressman John Lewis. Lewis was one of the organizers of the march and is the last speaker from that event who's alive today. Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke spoke with John Lewis in 2007, and Lewis described getting ready to address the march that day 50 years ago.
For early morning, August 28, 1963, I remember getting up, taking a shower, getting dressed, getting a bag to eat, leaving in some cars, all of us, the 10 speakers, going up to Capitol Hill to meet with the leaders of the Congress. I don't think I've been to Capitol Hill before, but we met with Democrats and Republicans on the House side, on the Senate side. And we came out of the Senate side near Constitution Avenue. We were supposed to be leading the march, or someone was going to drive us near the Washington Monument. And we came out. We thought maybe there'd be 50,000 or 60,000 people. There was a sea of humanity. And the people were already walking. And we just sort of locked on and started walking. And it was like, there go my people, let me catch up with them. And the sea of humanity just literally pushed us on past the Washington Monument toward the Lincoln Memorial. It was unreal. It was unreal. And when we got up to the top of the steps and looked out, it was more than 50 or 60 or 70,000, 100,000. I think the press reports and the local law enforcement people said it was more than 250,000. When I see still photographs and videos of what happened, I think it was a great undercount. Because there was people, you see black and white people standing there together, young people up in the trees, people with their feet in the reflecting pool trying to cool off. It represented America at a best. It was one of the finest hours. And I remember when I was called on to speak, I stood up, I looked to the right, I looked to the left, then I looked straight ahead, and I saw some of the young people from my organization, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. It seemed like they were saying, it's okay, go ahead. And I started to speak.
That was Congressman John Lewis speaking on Lake Effect in 2007. Lewis was one of the speakers at the March on Washington 50 years ago this week, and the last one who remains alive today. As Milwaukee gears up for Harley Fest, we'll talk to the owner of the largest Harley dealership in the area. So shift down and stick around. Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. The rumble of motorcycle engines is already reverberating through downtown Milwaukee ahead of this week's festivities celebrating the 110th anniversary of Harley-Davidson. It's a big week for motorcycle enthusiasts and for the iconic Milwaukee company. But with hundreds of thousands of bikers coming to southeastern Wisconsin, it's also a huge week for the area's largest Harley-Davidson dealer. House of Harley expects more than 100,000 people to take part in a series of events it will host on the streets around the dealership on Milwaukee's south side. John Schaller is the dealer principal, the owner of the dealership. He tells Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke how he sees the state of Harley-Davidson this year compared to where things were during the last celebration 5 years ago.
I think it's much more stable. We're at a much more certain time. I don't know that anyone thinks the economy is doing great, but at least we're not going into a recession. So I think that attitudes are better. I think after 5 years of recession, people also want to have fun. For the 105th, during 2008, what I think we saw was a lot of people, but not much economic activity. So the crowds felt a lot like the 100th, but not the attitude, the happiness. The people were happy and friendly to be here, but it wasn't the same kind of joyful event because we knew looming on the horizon was a not so good time.
I don't know if anyone has ever applied the word joie de vivre to the Harley crowd, it sounds like that might have been what was lacking.
I think to some extent. People were – again, it was a fun event, but there was also a difference. I think the phrase staycation had been already become part of our lexicon at that point, and people traveled, but there weren't people from all over the world, which was completely different than the 100th anniversary. People came and they left, and it just wasn't the same kind of, I guess, as you say, joie de vivre. Yeah.
Well, so flash forward to 2013, and just in recent days, there's been the announcement of the launch of the 2014 line. How significant are those new models, do you imagine, going to be for you?
I think it's going to be huge. It was fun to be at the dealer meeting where I was at until 2 days ago. Dealers are excited. Dealer staff is excited or are excited. And the Harley employees were excited too. They were constantly saying, John, what do you think? What do you think? What do you think? And it's because for the first time in 19 years, we have a bike that looks different. More than that, the manufacturing process, the new engine that has now coolant in it in some of the forms of the engine, the touchscreen infotainment center, which is, by the way, as high quality, fully featured as any automobile I've ever seen. All of those things, I think, contributed to an exciting dealer show, and I think it's going to contribute to an exciting time for customers as well. We had our Hog Chapter meeting last night. People were excited to see the new bike, and I think it's going to be a huge thing both for Harley and for Harley customers as well.
I realize it may be too soon to ask this question, but are you already getting customers in the store who are asking about them?
We've already sold the first three or four that came in. I rode mine home for the first time last night. It's a great ride. It's better. It's different. It's phenomenal.
I want to talk about what your dealership is going to be doing to take part in the 110th anniversary. Specifically, off the bat, I know one of the days, Sunday, is especially geared towards women riders. How are women riders and women Harley buyers changing things for you?
It's a huge demographic for us. We sell way above the national average of women as customers at our store. Part of that, I think, is the attitude, the makeup of our staff. But overall, the woman ridership is an incredibly important demographic for Harley-Davidson.
Well, what is it that you know that maybe some other Harley dealerships don't that allows you to have such a high percentage of women versus the national average?
I think it's simply an attitude that they are riders, that they are respected, that it's not talking to the husband when the husband and wife come in. You hear horror stories of what happens in some dealerships. We have a very experienced, I think, very professional sales group. More than that, we have a significant percentage of our employees as females. I mean, we have women mechanics. We have women in our internet sales. We have actually women throughout the store. And I think everybody likes to see somebody who looks like them when you go into shop. So it helps to, of course, have a significant women percentage of our staff.
Do you find – is it at all tricky for you to broaden your customer base without alienating your core demographic?
I think there was always that risk, and more of a risk probably 5 to 10 years ago. You know, the old white – I'm saying the old white guy like me. But that was the core for so many years. And over the last 5 to 10 years, it has changed significantly. One of the things that has done that is the Rider's Edge program. Harley began about 10 years ago. Motorcycle safety training, that is a program that supplements the training you would get at a technical school. More time on the course, smaller classes, and bikes that, frankly, are kept in much better shape. It's not the, you know, the technical schools simply don't have the funding to do what we can do. So that class and offering it at 12 students a week now for however many weeks we can keep it going before the snow flies and after it melts, over all these years has helped to bring in younger riders, women riders, Latinos, African Americans, demographic groups that we really didn't see much of before the last 10 years.
So we mentioned this one day, the Sunday is especially geared towards women riders. I know there is one of the people from Project Runway will be there who is, I guess, a Milwaukee native.
Yes, Miranda Levy.
What are the other highlights of the week as far as you're concerned?
We open on Wednesday. The street closes Monday, but it takes us 2 days to build the infrastructure. So what we do is we theme the days. Wednesday is Military Recognition Day. There is a huge population of present and former military personnel that are Harley riders. So on that day, we start with a parachute drop at 12:45. The program begins at 1. There'll be a flyover with the Wisconsin wing of the Commemorative Air Force. Before the sequestration, we had the Special Forces jump team and F-16s, but we've now had to go back to the other, but it'll still be cool. The governor will be there. We have three generals, including John Borling, who wrote Taps on the Walls, a book where he wrote down the poems he had created and memorized while he was a prisoner in the Hanoi Hilton for 6.5 years, along with John McCain and Bud Day. Gary Wetzel will be there, who's a friend and a customer, a Medal of Honor recipient. So three generals, Medal of Honor recipient, and the governor will lead our ride. We hope to have up to 1,000 motorcycles, and it's to support the Fisher House of Wisconsin. So each day we follow that. On Military Day, there will be Oshkosh Defense as one of our principal sponsors with huge, cool military vehicles. The Marine Corps is bringing its simulated firing range. So if you've never shot a 50 caliber machine gun or a mortar, you can actually do it.
If you've never shot a 50 caliber.
Yeah, if it's not part of your background. But all sorts of things that will be going on. The next day is Law Enforcement Day. And on Law Enforcement Day, we got Eric Estrada coming in, a friend of yours. And he'll be there. We have robot, bomb squad, canine, all sorts of interesting things. And the Marine Corps will leave its ISMET firing range there for marksman competitions. On that day, we support cops, concerns of police survivors. Next day is Firefighter Day. MDA is the beneficiary. Saturday, we are the Harley has asked us to be the Harleista Latino outreach kind of location. So we will take a parade down to the Bradley Center for the UFC fight and have Rico Obsession, so a Latino band there. In the afternoon, we change to the Britons, so we go from Mexico or Central America to the British Isles.
And this is a, there's a Beatles tribute band.
It is. Yep. Yeah, nationally known. I mean, I'd heard of it, so that's amazing. So on Sunday then is Susan Komen Foundation Women Rider Recognition Day, and that benefits the Susan Komen Foundation of Wisconsin. We hope to have 1,000 riders in pink shirts leading that parade. So every day there is a parade. There's a program that'll be short. We go for a ride, always escorted rides, and then generally come back to the dealership after it's over. And on Monday, we're doing a promotion with the Brewers.
How long have you been planning for your part of this this anniversary? And how much coordination do you do as this large dealer in Milwaukee with Harley-Davidson itself?
Well, we have started planning. We actually began meetings about a year and a half ago. And over time, we formed these committees. So we have all members, all service branches for the military on our committee. They help us choose the charity that benefits. So those meetings have been going on for a year and a half, and as time has gotten nearer, we talk about the J months. Once we got to June, we were down to every week having a meeting. The committees have met generally every month. So for a year and a half, it's been intense. Before we even began the real planning, we started doing bidding for porta-potties. I think we're probably the largest user of porta-potties.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, you're expecting 250,000 people to take part in just your part of this anniversary?
Well, I wish that would happen. I think it'll be 150-plus. The Greenfield Police estimated 100,000 at the 105th, so I think we'll easily hit 150 at the 110th.
The 110th is obviously bringing people from around the world to Milwaukee. But when it's over, do you think this event energizes your local customer base?
There has always been a halo effect. For the 100th, I think it lasted 6 months. Unfortunately, at the 105th, with the recession looming, it lasted 11 days. By September 11th, we had seen the majority of sales for September pass, and things started to go downhill then.
Do you actually get people from outside Milwaukee buying new Harleys when they're in town for an event like this?
We do. It's like they took the bus to get here. But the first bike we sold for the 105th was to a guy from New Jersey. He rode his bike in to buy a bike in Milwaukee.
Do Harley owners do trade-ins?
Absolutely, they do.
They don't hold on. There's not some kind of sentimental desire to hold on to their previous bike?
Well, good question. They're, not that any of your other questions aren't good.
I appreciate the qualifier there.
Yeah. Harley-Davidson owners have a significant pride of ownership. Some of them do hold on to their older bikes, and for good reason. It's nostalgic. It's part of their own personal history. But most trade. And what we receive from that is an incredible supply of beautifully maintained motorcycles. So the used bike business is actually bigger for us than our new bike business.
And yeah, I guess I didn't want to necessarily tar all Harley owners with the same brush, but I was. It seemed that there's more that goes into owning a Harley Davidson than goes into owning, I don't know, a Nissan Sentra.
Yes, there is.
Not to tar all Nissan Sentra owners with the same brush.
Yeah. So owning a Harley, I was lucky enough to appear on CNN on the night of the 100th on Saturday night. And Andrea Koppel said, okay, John, so what is it about Harley that makes a difference? My answer was that it's like being the last American cowboy. At night when you're riding and it's a cool evening, you'll go down in a dip and the air gets cool. You come up the other side and it's warm. My wife, who was from Iowa, was at the side of the camera, and I said, as a matter of fact, I can now tell you the difference between horse, cow, sheep, and pig manure just by the smell. I don't know if that's a life skill, but your senses are more alive. We have a convertible, and I would tell you there is a complete difference of experience between being on a motorcycle and being in a convertible. There's also the feeling of personal freedom. We truly enable that. The smiles, I don't know about Sentra salespeople, but when we deliver a motorcycle and we do it every day and we ring a bell and people from all over the dealership come to shake hands, and they do that without prompting because the smiles, the joy, if it's a new person to Harley, I welcome them to the family and I tell them their life has just changed for the better, and it truly has. And if they're a longtime rider, I thank them for being part of our family because it is a family experience. I talk about the motorcycle being just the entree to the lifestyle. It's the entry vehicle, if you will. There's a feeling when you ride a Harley, you know, when little old ladies and kids wave to you and they use all their fingers. There's nothing like it.
How did you get into this business?
Well, I'm a recovering attorney. I've been a trial lawyer here in town for 20 years and was looking for something more fun to do. So I bought a Harley, and I loved it. I used to be a ski racer of sorts, not very good, but it gave that same kind of thrill to me that really wasn't in anything else I was doing. So I enjoyed it. I had represented the owner, former owner of the store, and we started talking, and it led to me buying the dealership.
Well, and let me ask you this question. You know, this is a question I've asked to people who take something that they love and make it their job in a variety of settings. Is it at all conflicting to you to take this thing that represents such great freedom and such enjoyment to you and add the additional layer that this is your job every day?
Interesting. Never thought of it that way. I guess I would answer by saying that it's fun to go to work. I mean, the worst thing that happens is I have to go ride a motorcycle. I mean, oh my goodness. We have a great ability to satisfy our customers. Now, we hope we don't have many unhappy. We're not going to please everybody, and we can't be taken for a ride by someone. But an unhappy customer can so easily be turned into a happy customer. So that's one part of this job that's different. I enjoy the business of business. So the fact that it's a motorcycle business makes it just some magnitude higher than any other job that I certainly have experienced. The smiles, again, if we were selling – I don't want to malign anyone's brands, but if we're selling Sentras since we were talking about them, it's just not the same. You know, you get on a bike. I used to call it actually a friend of mine coined this, an enema for your brain. You can come home crabby, get on your bike and take a 45-minute ride and come back and be smiling. There's just – and, you know, people talk about it's dangerous. Well, you get killed walking through parking lots. I tell people to take the motorcycle safety course, the rider's edge course. I tell them to ride defensively and never be drinking, never be on drugs, of course. And then the final hedge is go to church on Sunday because you never know. But if you want to open your life up, if you want to expand your horizons, if you want to expand the senses of living, there is nothing like it in the world that I've experienced.
Well, John Shaler, thanks so much and happy anniversary.
Mitch, thank you very much.
John Shaler is the president and dealer principal of House of Harley, a Harley-Davidson dealership on Milwaukee's South Side. There's a link to the full slate of activities the dealer has planned for Harley's 110th anniversary, plus more about the full commemoration at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Stick around, there's more of Lake Effect to come in just a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Are some people just born evil, or does our world and what we encounter in life turn us evil? Philosophers, writers, religious scholars, and psychologists have pondered these questions since time immemorial. And they're at the heart of Waukesha writer Kathy Giorgio's latest novel, Learning to Tell a Lifetime. It's the follow-up to her award-winning 2011 book, The Home for Wayward Clocks. In that first story, abused and neglected teen Cooley finds care, compassion, and friendship from an isolated old man named James, who incidentally runs a clock museum. Giorgio tells Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce she hadn't intended to write a sequel to Cooley's initial story.
No, and in fact, during the book tour for The Home for Wayward Clocks, I was asked all the time, are you going to do a sequel? And I said, absolutely not. Because it took me 3 years to write the clock book. It took me 3 years to sell it. So I'd been out of it for a very, very long time. This book is an accidental book. I was at a warm stone massage. And I was actually 176 pages into another book that I was writing. So I had no thought of doing anything. And I'm laying there on the massage table. I'm totally blissed out. I'm face down. And all of a sudden, the opening line, Cooley never expected to cry when her mother died, came across my eyes. And I swore. And the massage therapist said, what? Did I hurt you? And I said, no, I have to go home and write a book. And by the time the therapy or the massage therapy was done, I knew it was 16 years later. I knew Cooley was 32. I knew James had passed away. He was not going to be a part of this book. I knew that Ione was in a progressive type home, which starts with assisted living and then goes to a nursing home. And I knew that her mother had just died. And that's all I knew. But it was enough to go home and start working on it.
As an author, were you afraid to disturb where you had left these characters? I mean, at the end of The Home for Wayward Clocks, we kind of have a sweet ending mm-hmm. with Cooley going to live with James and that relationship really blossoming. But instead of just leaving them there in that kind of permanent, happy place, you go ahead and you write this book, dredging up Cooley's...
All sorts of stuff.
All sorts of things.
I was scared. Partly because, number one, it seems when people read a sequel, they always say, oh, it was pretty good, but the first one was better. And I absolutely don't want that to happen, which is why I think the sequel stands on its own. You do not have to read The Home for Wayward Clocks in order to read this book. But it was also the idea in my head was that we have James in The Home for Wayward Clocks who had a severely abused childhood and who reacted to it by becoming completely isolated from the world. Then as I wrote this book, I discovered Cooley's mother had also a pretty bad background, different from James, but still a rough background. And her way of dealing with it was to start abusing Cooley. And now here's Cooley, who has been raised by this woman and saved by James. And I was like, there has to be one more step. There has to be a step to show that you can step away from that kind of background and live a completely normal life. And so I had to go back and write about her.
Now, as Cooley begins to learn about her mother and her mother's past in a way that she'd never been interested, inclined to learn about before, given that she was abused at the hands of her mother, we begin to learn what her mother experienced.
Right.
Are we meant to like her, to forgive her for what she's done to Cooley?
You are not meant to forgive her. You know, you are meant to learn how this could happen. How could a woman become someone who could burn her child with cigarettes? And, I mean, when I started to write this book, that wasn't even my intention. When I did the clock book, Cooley's mother was Cooley's mother. She didn't even have a name. She was just somebody who burned her child with cigarettes and who was an alcoholic. When I started this book and I knew I wanted the short stories to be concerning her mother, I didn't expect to like her. I didn't expect to feel for her. But I did as the story started to come out. It's really my first time writing from the abusive mind as opposed to the abused mind. And I learned so much about this in that she was a person. She was a child. And she was not born evil. She is not a monster. She became a monster. And things happened to her to lead her down that path. And I think that's what I'm trying to show more than anything, is that whenever we have bad things happen in our country, our first response is, oh, that's evil. And we point fingers and we say that person is evil. That person isn't evil. That person maybe became evil, but certainly wasn't born that way. And we need to know more about how did we get from here to there? How did this person become that way? Because we can dole out all the punishment we want. That's only going to stop that person. It's not going to keep the next person from developing that way.
That's interesting you say that. Do you have particular events in mind that you're referring to?
You know, especially while I was writing it, we had a lot of things happen in this country. We had the man who went in and shot up the movie theater. We had Sandy Hook. We had the Boston Marathon kids. We now have Castro with keeping the three women kidnapped. And just
and
a couple
Sikh temple shooting
exactly.
Right here in our own backyard.
Yes. And just recently, just 2 weeks ago, when Castro was put into prison for life for doing this, he made a statement that said, you're making me look like a monster. I'm not a monster. I'm sick. And everybody was very horrified at that statement. And in fact, both are true. He is sick and he became a monster. They aren't mutually exclusive. And I hope what will happen with him in prison now for life is that there will be a whole lot of talking going on to figure out how did this man wake up one morning and decide to do this? Something made him turn left instead of going right. And in this book, too, something made Mara Rose on – I wrote the chapter about the very first time she burns Cooley. Hardest chapter of the book to write because at that point I knew this character really well and I so wanted her not to do it. I wanted her to save herself. I couldn't do that. You know, I had to kind of stick with the first book, but I had to make her go through with it and watch her do it and realize this is where she makes her big mistake. This is where the mind bends and she starts to go down that path instead of staying on the straight and narrow.
You juxtapose two scenes, one a rape scene,
mm-hmm.
one a scene of statutory rape, molestation. And in the first book, you had written so much about physical abuse.
Mm-hmm.
Is it different to write about sexual abuse versus physical abuse?
I think it is. What I found the most compelling as I wrote this book, and I did a lot of research with this. I visited therapy groups that were dealing with people who had childhood sexual abuse. And one of the things that I think everybody finds the hardest to understand and to believe is that often that person doesn't hate the person that did it to them. There is a feeling of love for this person. There's a feeling in a lot of cases of gratitude. And that was certainly the case with Mara Rose. She was neglected by her mother. But here was this neighbor man who stepped forward and was lavishing all sorts of attention on her. And she loved him. She wanted to grow up and marry him. And it wasn't until much later that she realized the relationship was bad. The relationship was one that never, ever should have happened. And that's so hard for people to understand. And you'll never see it on a Lifetime TV movie, having an abused victim come forward and say, but I loved my abuser. I really wanted to be with my abuser. Because you don't think of it as abuse when you're a kid.
Do you think you were able at first to really understand?
No. I think I understood it as I wrote the book and got more into it and got into that head. And, you know, I juxtaposed the two. In Mara Rose's case, she always wants to get back to that man. She always wants to be with him. She wishes – he ends up dying in the book. She wonders what would have happened if she had made it to 18 and they were able to have a legal relationship. She always refers back to that as being – something she misses. In Cooley's case, she gets seduced by an internet stalker who she thinks is a young boy who is 1 year older than she is. Turns out he's a much older man and he rapes her. But in her mind, she still thinks of that boy that she knew on the internet. It's very hard for her to separate the two. And she still misses him. Even though he ended up not being who he was supposed to be, in her mind, she misses that boy.
And to a certain extent, she's surprised when she realizes after she finds out her mother has died that she loves that abuser as well.
Right, right.
What pushes Cooley to want to explore who her mother was, the part of her mother that she didn't know about?
There's – at the beginning of the book, one of the things she finds is an old photo album. And she sees a picture of her mother as a young girl sitting on the front porch, looking straight ahead and just as wide-eyed and innocent as she can be. And that child is so different than the mom Cooley knew. And there was something about seeing that little girl that made her want to know, who was this woman? Why did she turn out the way she turned out? Why couldn't she have been a mother to me? And that's what fueled her forward. She realized all these things she didn't know about her mom. She didn't know if her grandparents were still alive. She didn't know where her mother came from. She didn't know anything. She hadn't spoken to her mother for 16 years. And that was what pushed her forward. I think also suddenly being on her own. There are no more parents. James is gone. Ione is on the way out. And she realizes here she is in the world and she's not sure where her ties are. And so she needed to reach out.
You know, these days in movies and television, even books, we see a lot of violence against women depicted. And it's not always handled with the best of care. But in this case, in your book, you seem like you have a bigger mission in mind by using those elements to reach out to your readers in a certain way.
I guess I'm trying to do so much, I think, in this book. in that what I started out with talking about how I want to show that there isn't just good and evil, that there is all of these things in between. I do get frustrated whenever there is a big news event because it seems like as soon as we say that person was evil, it's like we're removing responsibility from ourselves as well. We couldn't possibly have changed that. We couldn't have seen that coming. We couldn't have stepped in and stopped these things from happening. That person was evil. There was no stopping them. I'd like to stop that. You know, I think there is a way of stepping in and preventing these things. In Cooley's case, you know, I can remember back in – I was a teenager. It was probably around 1976 was when the first statistics came forward that if you were abused, you were likely to become an abuser. And I remember even thinking at the time, man, that must feel like a life sentence. Not only have you been abused, but you're going to grow up to hurt other people too. There are boatloads of people out there who have been in abusive situations who have not gone on to hurt other people. We need to know why. You know, why do some people continue that chain? Why do they lose control and go ahead and keep this thing going where others will step out of that same situation and stop and be able to stop it? The more we learn about that, the more we can make it stop right away rather than continuing the whole thing.
Well, Kathy Giorgio, thank you so much for coming in and telling us about Learning to Tell a Lifetime.
Thank you.
Kathy Giorgio is the author of the new novel, Learning to Tell a Lifetime, which is being released on September 1st. It's a sequel to her first novel, The Home for Wayward Clocks, and she's also the author of the short story collection, Enlarged Hearts. Giorgio will be the keynote speaker at the 2013 Southeast Wisconsin Festival of Books on September 20th. In the interest of full disclosure, Stephanie Lecce will be doing an on-air Q&A with Giorgio at that event. You can find more of their conversation about this book at WUWM.com. I'm Bonnie Knorr. Thanks so much for joining us today. We're back tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect right here on 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. See you then. Stay tuned for Fresh Air Now. It's coming up next.